This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today it's our monthly visit with Governor Daniel Malloy. We'll take your questions at 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. You can email us wherewelive@wnpr.org, and you can tweet us at wherewelive. We're also live today on CTN. Coming up, we'll be talking about the new two-year budget that the governor just signed, among other things. But first, I'd like to welcome you, Governor. Thanks for coming back.
Yeah, no, it's nice to be back.
You signed an executive order creating the Office of Early Childhood yesterday. Can you tell us what this office will do?
It's going to coordinate our activities on birth through age 8 with a heavy concentration initially around the delivery of services to make sure that children are ready to learn so that they come to kindergarten fully prepared with the kinds of vocabularies and pre-literacy skills that they need. There'll also be a concentration on making sure that our children are doing well in school by the time they're in third grade, that they are on or as close to grade level as they need to be competitive in fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. And that's a very important dividing line, third grade. We also want to make sure that parents have access to services in a young child's life that will allow that child to grow up healthy, as well as gaining the skill set necessary to be successful in school. This department will have about 70 employees initially. They're coming from five different departments across state government to be concentrated in a single operation, which is concentrating on the early life of a child.
Now, one of the things that I want to ask you about before we meet the person who's going to be heading up this new department is that I know that we've talked in the past about trying to create a continuum for education in the state that really starts at birth and goes all the way through college. And I just want to make sure I understand how this new office jives with this idea that you've long held and a lot of other education reformers in the state have held, that really we do want to start at birth and go all the way through college. Do we need a separate department in order to...
devoted to this issue, or partially devoted to this issue. And that has been terribly inefficient. One of the things that I've tried to bring to state government in Connecticut is a level of efficiency. Having the people that are working on the same issue sitting side by side, collaborating on a daily basis is very important to getting the job done. So we're not creating a new department. We're going from five to a single one, I think is a better way to think about it. And yes, there is a continuum. If we're not properly preparing children for school, if children are arriving in kindergarten and first grade with a vocabulary of 5,000 fewer words than their counterparts, then they're going to have a very hard time catching up. And in point of fact, they don't catch up. That's the problem, and are very few catch up. And so we need to close that gap, that education gap, that achievement gap that exists in the state of Connecticut at a much earlier stage than what we have previously been thinking about. You know, we always thought that if we gave every child the opportunity to learn, we were doing what we had to do. And it's not about opportunity. It's about success. And if you're planning for success as opposed to the planning for the distribution of opportunity, it's a very different mindset. And that's the mindset we're trying to bring to the early child.
The person in charge of making this big change for the state is Myra Jones Taylor, Executive Director of the Office of Early Childhood. She joins us in studio today. Welcome.
Well, I have to make an announcement.
Oh, please.
Because you just made an assumption.
I made an assumption?
She has been the Director of Planning.
But
as of today, I announced that she will be the Director of the Office.
So I jumped ahead.
Yes, you did.
I made the announcement on air, and
you
I
did.
Apologize.
Yeah,
you should
no,
do that.
No, I just did.
Okay.
But Myra, she's done a great job in bringing all of the voices together. And the amount of support that this effort has had in the legislature and amongst the community of advocates, as well as the community of providers, has really been tremendous. So I'm very proud to announce today that she will be my director of this office and will sit in on all of our important cabinet meetings and that sort of thing, because this is a priority for me.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So what are you going to do in this job? What do you see as your goal?
Right. So, I mean, I think the governor touched on the first issue, which is the inefficiencies of this, of our non-system. We currently have five different agencies providing services, early childhood services, and it's not efficient. There are amazing workers who are contribute, who are dedicated to this, have dedicated their lives, their careers to this, but we don't always work in concert. We don't always have one common vision, one policy directive, one unified vision around budget. So getting everybody together and working in that same direction around early childhood, around children and families, and not, you know, they're amazing people who've been in other agencies, but their focus, they have much bigger, broader mandates. The Department of Education, Department of Social Services, all those agencies have commissioners who are dedicated to this, but they have bigger fish to fry, if you will. This office, the brilliance of the governor's plan is to have one agency that is focused solely on the young children and their families in the state, and making sure that our programs are doing the best so we can make them successful.
Maybe you can talk about trying to get your arms around what is currently provided for a pre-K education in the state, because there is a wide range. There's plenty of great private programs. There are public programs. There are lots of kids who go completely without. Try to give us a sense of what exactly is out there that you're trying to corral right now.
Right. You're right. So the first is there are children who go without. And then we have children who receive care, what's called family, friend, and neighbor care, kith and kin care, where they receive care from parents, caregivers, neighbors, and they often receive subsidies, our Care for Kids subsidy, for that if they're low income. Then we have family, friend, or family child care providers who are, in communities across the state, rural, urban, everywhere, providing care in small groups. And then we have center-based care. And then we also have care in our public schools. So we have a whole range of care. But there isn't necessarily one person who's actually saying, okay, what do we mean about quality? What do we say for quality? What should quality look like for that family, friend, and neighbor care? And what should it look like in a public school? And what we're saying, and we're following the directive of the governor and the directive of the President Obama, where they're going with this, the federal government, and saying we need quality across the board. So that's one big thing, wrapping our arms around that and improving quality for every child, every setting, every age.
What this is not, and I've been very clear and have to be very clear, right. This is not about adding a year or 2 years to school as it's been traditionally provided. This is not an extra year of kindergarten or 2 years totally at the public expense. What we really have to build is we have to lift quality across the board in all of the ways that services are provided. But we also have to close that very big gap of children who have no service, no real service, no educative processes taking place before the age of five. That's what we have to close. And no child should be denied that early education because of their parents' financial circumstances. To allow that to go on is literally cutting off your nose to spite your face. These children are unlikely to be successful if they show up in kindergarten without pre-literacy skills. And that's a very big gap that we're concentrating on closing. That's why we added 1,000 additional early childhood education spots last year to the budget. In arguably some of the most difficult times, we expanded that program. And that's why Myers has this job to do and why we needed to pull this operation together. Because what we have to do is figure out how to deliver these services to the children who would otherwise not have them in the most cost-effective way.
So because cost efficiency is an important piece here, and because we have so many different systems that, as you say, we're trying to pull together, talk about getting the quality up in for these children who right now either don't have any services, obviously we want to get them services, or who have some sort of a home-based service. How do you, and maybe the wrong word is impose, but impose some sort of quality standard on home care that has previously not had any?
Right. I think there are many ways to do it, and there are some ways that are already happening currently in the state. I think first is you actually look at where everybody is and don't assume that there isn't quality everywhere just because they're not in a
center.
Right. I think the governor is very keen on making sure that we have quality everywhere and assuming that we have to do this cost effectively. And so we cannot get everybody into a public school situation. We cannot afford that. So making sure that wherever a child is, they receive that quality. There are ways that states have been doing this. Obviously, we are going to follow suit. A quality rating and improvement system is one important way. The foundation, really, if you think about quality, is basic health and safety. We can start there with our licensing inspections. So one thing there is thinking, okay, What do we mean around basic health and safety for children? Are they healthy? Are they safe? But building in quality components there, not just having this kind of compliance driven, which I think the governor is very keen also on making sure we don't do that, but actually thinking about child quality and child development in a quality setting when you're thinking about health and safety, building that into our licensing.
And training.
And
training for parents as well as care providers. Having people first of all, having people be comfortable with reading to a child, right, is very, very important. If you read to a child 20 minutes a day, that child is going to grow up enjoying that experience and wanting to do it themselves as quickly as they possibly can, because that's who we are as human beings. We want to replicate the behaviors that we enjoy. Getting people to a comfort level to do that is takes work because a lot of people are not comfortable. There may be language barriers. There may be cultural barriers. So we have to overcome that. But ongoing training to providers is going to be a very important component part.
We're talking with Governor Malloy and his new executive director of the Office of Early Childhood, Myra Jones Taylor. We're taking your calls at 860-275-7266. Phil is on a cell phone. Hi there, Phil. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live. Hi, Phil. Are you there? Perhaps Phil's line dropped. That happens sometimes. I want to ask you, Myra Jones Taylor, about some of your philosophies about this, about how you prepare kids before school, because there are a lot of different philosophies out there. And as I've said periodically on the show, I don't talk about it a lot, but I'm married to someone who teaches four-year-olds. And so I hear a lot of stories about what it's like to teach four-year-olds every day. And every single kid is different, and every single kid is at a different stage of development. Some are ready to read, and some aren't ready to read. A lot of them just aren't ready to stand in line. And right. So there's a lot of things developmentally that have to happen before you can drill them on tests. So maybe you can talk about your philosophy of how you develop a child, but then also teach a child and get him or her ready for the learning that needs to happen.
Right. I think I actually would like to start beyond education. I think as a parent or as an educator, we know that it's not just about education. It is about making sure that a child comes from a stable family. And this office will not be doing that. But supporting, working with other commissioners who that is their mandate, and to make sure that what we're doing in the Office of Early Childhood around education, around care and education, is also working in concert to make sure that families are stable. So the training that the Governor Malloy talked about, expanding that to families. There are family resource centers that do an incredible work with families and parents. And so making sure that really a child comes from a home where reading is part of the fabric of that family. To your point about, you know, the philosophy here, all children are different. That is the beauty of childhood. That is the beauty of early childhood education and care. Starting at that as the starting point is important, but realizing that we have to get them ready, that we have to have them prepared for kindergarten. So having that kind of that play base, that enriched, that very engaging child development process is key here. I think also, you know, it's not having too much of a didactic experience, but actually having children ready to recognize their letters is important. We have, this is a brand new world here in terms of education, and we have high expectations for children. We don't want them to be behind, but we also want them to enjoy. There's active engagement, there's health, there's nutrition, all of that is part of this.
But could you talk about that balance, having high expectations for children and needing to quantify whether or not you're doing a good job on that and providing that experience that is, again, different for kids who are so very young because there is so much importance in play and other things. How do you balance these two things? It seems like that's an important line to draw.
Oh, it's a huge challenge, and this is something that right now that we're actually approaching a consortium of states that are working on this, is kindergarten entry assessments, because it is so difficult. You don't want to have some canned test. Children are horrible test takers. They're 4-year-olds aren't supposed to be, you know, taking these kind of
probably not.
They're not reliable test takers, but there are ways to assess their development and their growth that are useful that we can use for instructional practices, for policy making decisions. And so we're working hopefully with a few states right now on a national consortium of developing a kindergarten entry assessment that we're working on. This is, people have not figured this one out yet.
Yeah, but I think that we have figured out, much of the industrialized world has figured out, that children should start a formal educative process before the age of 5. Mm-hmm. That much we now have established. So your wife being involved in education at 4 is spot on. And in point of fact, many children in our state begin their educative process at age 3. They do 2 years of pre-K, privately provided because their parents can afford it, which means they come to school knowing how to behave, identifying all of their colors, knowing right from left, identifying, if reading in some cases, certainly identifying letters in most other cases, that skill set and an enriched vocabulary. That skill set is what we want every child to be beginning kindergarten in the state of Connecticut. We ultimately also need to have a universal full-day kindergarten program in our state, as well as universal access to early childhood education. So this office will be responsible from birth, have responsibilities from birth to age eight. But I want to be very clear, and I know that the director understands this, that what we've got to get to as quickly as possible is a quality, formalized, educative process for all children in the state of Connecticut, that no child is denied that because of their financial circumstances.
And to that end, quickly before I let you go, a tweet came in from Alice who says, can you talk about children with developmental delays or disabilities from ages 0 to 5 and your office? What will you provide?
Right. So right now, so we have an incredible system, the Birth to Three system, a program that's in the Department of Developmental Services. Right now, that is not slated to come into the Office of Early Childhood. It was at one point, and now we are doing a study on the feasibility of doing that. But I'm working closely with Linda Goodman and her team on those. Very early intervention is a big part of this. So making sure that is, again, part of the team, hopefully we'll get that in, we'll do that feasibility study, and that will prove to legislatures that this should be brought into the Office of Early Childhood. We're also working on an Early Childhood Comprehensive Services Grant, a federal grant right now, that is working with Help Me Grow, which is an incredible outreach system that has parents, if they have identified a child who has delays, they go straight to this phone number and they can receive services, they can get an evaluation. So making sure that is integrally involved in the whole system is part of this plan.
Let me just say this, I think in general terms we support an inclusion model as soon as an identification is made. Children with developmental disabilities do best when they're with their peers who are without those disabilities. They bring one another along. Compassion grows as well as shared educative processes. So in general terms, to whoever sent that message, I want that person to know that we think that the best models allow for children to be integrated as soon as possible.
Just very, very quickly, Governor, because I do have to take a break here. Does the fact that you had to create this office by executive order mean anything in particular? Does there still have to be legislative action somewhere along the line?
Well, there should be legislative action, and there were things that don't get done under an executive order, a membership of committees and that sort of thing, which was addressed in the legislation. But the reason we're able to do this is all of this was put into the budget. They didn't get to they didn't call the bill that did other things. So this is kind of a bridge. I certainly want the legislature, whenever it comes into session next, to take up the bill that would probably had universal or would have had all but a couple of votes in each house in favor of it. It needs to be part of our law so that there needs to be real legislative change. But this is the start. The office is up and running or will be as of July 1st, and we have a director.
And the director is Myra Jones-Taylor, who's just been appointed. And so congratulations once again. Thank you for joining us. And we'll have you back again sometime to talk at length about this.
Great. Thank you so much.
When we come back, we'll be talking with Governor Daniel Malloy about the new two-year budget he just signed. We'll be taking a lot of your questions at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, join WNPR producers along with local musicians, artists, and storytellers in a tribute to La Paloma Sabanero, the Hartford Coffee House that has played host to our Ear Cave events as well as countless other community events. It's closing its doors at the end of the month, so you can stop by and say goodbye. I'll bet that there will be 1,000 interesting ideas that come out of some of the connections made, as per usual, at La Paloma. You can check out our brand new Where We Live Facebook page for more information. Governor Daniel Malloy is our guest today. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. You just signed a new two-year budget into law. How do you feel about the budget you signed?
You know, it's a budget. It does most of what it needs to do. I don't agree with all of it because it's a legislative process, but it gets the job done. It will allow us to expand medical coverage to tens of thousands of individuals come January 1st. Those programs will begin being offered on October 1st. This budget had to be put together in such a way that we could move forward with the expansion of those programs. We can now do that. I'm very proud of the support for education, for instance. Very proud of the support for bioscience and job growth in this state. We've created 36,000 private sector jobs. Or actually, let me put it the right way. The marketplace has created 36,000 private sector jobs since I became governor, the fastest job growth that we've seen in a very, very long time. And this budget allows us to continue that work as well.
I want to get to Bethy's question, actually, which takes us to sort of the next piece of our conversation. Bethy, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Good morning, Governor.
Good morning.
Good Mom, this question is in reference to the gas tax hike.
Sure.
I just wanted to know if you can clarify that the gas tax hike that taken effect July 1st was not established during your administration. Rather, the rail administration.
My, I want to thank you for calling with that question. In fact, it was a Republican proposal that the Senate minority leader and the House minority leader both voted for. It was, in essence, a promise to funders and to the future that we would address the infrastructure needs of the state of Connecticut. I have a very broad agenda on transportation, what Connecticut needs to do. We need to expand our rail system from New Haven through Hartford through Springfield. We need to do a lot of track improvements along the Metro North line. We need 95 to be three lanes in each direction for its entirety. We need 84 to be three lanes in its in each direction in its entirety. We need to replace bridges throughout the state of Connecticut. All of this is going to cost money, and we don't have tolls in the state of Connecticut. So, you know, And we're one of the few states that doesn't have tolls help pay for this. The only way we have to pay for these programs is the primary one is the revenue from fuel taxes. And we need to spend more money on building infrastructure so that we can be competitive with other states in New England and the other really 49 other states.
But when you talk about being competitive with other states, we are more expensive in the amount that we pay for gas than our neighbors because of not only our gas prices right now, but our gas tax hike that's going into effect July 1st.
But we don't have tolls. And so when you calculate that back in to what the cost of operating a car is in Massachusetts as opposed to Connecticut, there really is no difference.
When you talk about the money going into fix bridges, to fix highways, the money that comes from this gross receipts tax is supposed to go into the special transportation fund. And from what I understand, from the way I've read the budget, it goes into the special transportation fund, but is essentially being shifted over into the general fund. The money is going from the gross receipts tax into a special transportation fund, but it's not ending up there.
So let's deal with that issue right
sure.
now. Sure. First of all, more money will go into that fund and stay into that fund than has happened in the past. And we are weaning off of the practice that you've just described. I want to be very clear. Money has been taken out of that fund for years for budgetary purposes. And money was not fairly allocated into that fund until I established the allocation formula. So that by the second year of the biennium budget, the amount of money coming out of that is $15 million, a gigantic drop-off from what it was when I became governor of the state of Connecticut. And substantially more money will be going and staying in that fund. And you're absolutely right. That's one of the imperfections of budgets. But you don't get to wipe the slate clean. On day one. You have to kind of make progress, and we are making substantial progress. And I've just laid out for you a very broad vision of what our transportation policy needs to be. I didn't touch on the airport. I didn't touch on a lot of other things that need to be done. We're going to have a world-class transportation system in Connecticut. The sooner that we get into all of these dollars being spent in that regard, the happier I'm going to be, I can assure you.
But so when will that happen, and when will we make this transition? Because as we get through some of the things that have happened with this imperfect budget, as you call it, we're looking at the possibility of a budget hole already in the next two-year budget. And so I guess I'm wondering when we start to make these changes to put money away to fix the roads.
We're making changes constantly. And so that changed, because you asked a very direct question. When will that be completed? In the next 2 years. That's when it's completed. In the second year of the biennium, it's down to 15. Following that, it should be 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. That's what we've planned for. So no money would be coming out because you can't do Route 11. You can't do 95. You can't do improvements on 91. You can't do the improvements that are necessary on 84 unless we start directing all of that money there. And by the way, there's a bigger, broader issue. We don't have tolls, and people are getting more miles per gallon, which means that revenue source is going to go down, and it's about to go down rapidly because the CAFRA standards that the Obama administration established with the motor vehicle industry are going to mean that there's less taxes coming in, not more taxes coming in. Just think about how many more miles you get per gallon with your car today versus the car that you might have driven in the 90s or the early 2000s or just a few years ago. So this is all a big framework. And, you know, anyone can throw things around, even guys who voted for the tax, even guys who voted for the tax and are responsible for its implementation can say that they're against it because there's no consequences. But I'll tell you what the real consequences have been, a transportation system that's pretty darn bad.
Well, but to that end, I mean, your own administration has suggested that you need to make a certain amount of improvements, a certain amount of money just to maintain current services. And from my reading of the budget, you've underfunded that. There's not enough money going toward actually providing those services that you indeed say should be paying for the roads
and
the
bridges. But more money's going. But more money than last year.
More money than the year before. What I'm saying is not as much as your own administration has said should be there in order to provide the services we need.
You're right. We cannot solve that underfunded problem that has existed for the better part of 20 years overnight. You're absolutely right. This is about making steady progress on a whole bunch of fronts on issues that, quite frankly, have been mishandled in the state of Connecticut for many years. No one can say I'm not making progress. No one can say that I'm not putting more money in. No one can say that I don't have a plan for what needs to be done. No one can say that there's not a process to perfect that plan. All of that's going on. But tell me, how would you make more progress if you actually have less money coming in? And that's going to be the big issue because we're going to have to figure this thing out. We don't have tolls. We want to do a lot of things in transportation. We do rely on a tax as opposed to Massachusetts, as opposed to neighboring states. How are we going to do all of these things that we need to do? And I'm working on this on a daily basis.
Well, Stephen Wood tweets us. He says, well, how about interstate tolls so we can lessen, as he says, the damn gas tax? What about tolls?
Let me just do one other thing. When we talk about the what this gas tax increase means. It's $18.25 on average over a year's time.
For a person, for an individual driver.
Right, who's driving 12,000 miles. So let's be very, very clear. First of all, we can't get tolls in the state of Connecticut if we decide that that's the road we want to go down without a planning process and approval of the federal government. For instance, they recently denied Rhode Island about a year ago, Rhode Island's a plan to basically have an entrance and exit toll, which is what the proposal has long been in Connecticut. You only charge the people who are coming over your state lines on any one of the roads. That was denied in Rhode Island. So we have to present a plan of what we're going to do. Transportation-wise, and whether or not the legislature wants to move forward with tolls, and I don't think there's a lot of support for tolls in the legislature, that's a decision that would have to be made. But a lot of the early work has not been done that even have that discussion. And later today, I'll be announcing that we're kicking off that effort.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266 with Governor Daniel Malloy. It's his monthly visit to Where We Live. We're happy to have him here. You can also send us your tweets at Where We Live. Quickly before we move on from this, Andrew tweets us, does Connecticut's gas tax help at all with city streets, or is that a municipal matter?
That's a municipal matter. But in many municipalities, there are streets that are in the municipality that are state roads. You should think of Route 1 or Boston Post Road or whatever it's called in your jurisdiction as a state road in most cases. Routes, things that have RT in front of them are generally state roads. So there are state roads in most municipalities, but the other roads are the obligation of the municipality.
Can we get back to that number that your administration is projecting a few years out? After you get through this two-year budget, it says there that looking forward to the fiscal year 16, there's a $712 million hole. There's other gaps in years beyond that that are showing up, but let's just concentrate on that one. How do we end up with a $700 million hole 2 years out if we balanced a budget? Have we actually balanced a budget? I guess what I'm asking, if we are projecting that there's going to be a gap in the next year after that.
Now, there's not been a budget that hasn't projected a gap, as far as I'm aware, in the history of budget making. But lots of things change that, how well the economy is doing, as well as how rapidly you create the efficiencies that we've been making relatively rapidly in the state of Connecticut. Excuse me. We have already reduced spending in many areas very substantially in the state of Connecticut. There are well over 1,300 fewer employees, somewhere between 1,300 and 1,600 fewer employees in state government today than the day I was sworn in a state that's created 36,000 private sector jobs in that same period of time. So, what you have to do is get a read for where the economy is and what expenses you're actually going to continue or discontinue. And we're not afraid to discontinue expenses. We've done a lot of that in state government since I became governor.
Of course, one of the things that is going to have to happen if we're going to close that gap is that our economy will have to pick up even more. This report that came out since the last time I saw you from the Bureau of Economic Analysis shows Connecticut was last in economic growth last year, the only state in the nation where the combined value of goods and services produced shrank compared with 2011. That's not a good sign for the state. And obviously, we need to generate more growth if we're going to, again, close that gap, but move forward as a state, create new jobs.
Yeah, there are different things being measured there. For instance, it's not that's not an income measurement, that's an output measurement. We had some pretty extraordinary storms during that year. I would argue that we've been more adversely impacted by storms in the last 2.5 years than any other state in the nation. It also restated numbers that we were the worst hit state or one of the worst hit states in the downturn in 2009, and actually they restated the losses there, that which were estimated a 3.3% decline to a 3.6% decline, and then indicated for the last 2 years it was a 0.1 decline. So basically, we've been bumping along. But there are lots of signs. The creation of 36,000 private sector jobs, the number of houses and apartments being constructed in the state of Connecticut, the expansion of higher education in the state of Connecticut are all good signs. The growth in the hospitality industry and attendance at events is another good sign. So I inherited a state that was pretty messed up. That's the reality. It wasn't just messed up because of the declines of 2009, 2010. It was messed up because we hadn't grown a single net job in 22 years during a time that 48 states shared in the creation of 23 million jobs. We didn't get a single one of them on a net basis, only Michigan and ourselves. That's what I inherited, folks. I didn't create that mess. In fact, I was in local government. I wasn't even in state government during that period of time. And we were doing pretty darn well in Stamford during most of that period of time. Now what we're trying to do is build a Connecticut economy that will compete for decades to come. That's why our investments at the University of Connecticut, as well as the region system, which includes our four state universities, community colleges, and online colleges, are so very important. That's why our bioscience initiative is so very important. I'll give you perhaps a more important statistic than the one you were citing.
Sure.
In the 8 years prior to my becoming governor, our Department of Economic Development interacted, made investments with, grants to, whatever you want to call it, to 119 companies. I've been governor for 2.5 years, and we've done the same with over 900 companies. So if you want to lay the groundwork for future success, you invest in young companies, startups, technology, and you make sure that your education system is producing enough engineers, mathematicians, scientists, and technologists so that you can be competitive. That's who we are today. I'm not responsible for what happened before. I'm responsible for what's happening today and what's going to happen going forward.
But could you just be a bit more specific, and then we'll move on about how we look at this first year after this two-year budget gap and what exactly you do to close it? Because some things that you've already done in order to close this gap right now, and it was, as you've said time and again, it was huge, the hole that you had to fill. But you've done things like refinance old debt, et cetera, things that can happen one time but can't happen over and over and over again. So how do we get a $712 million hole that we're looking at as soon as this budget's over?
Okay, let me just point something out.
Yeah.
There are lots of things that get thrown around there. During the 2.5 years that I've been governor, We have paid off $400 million of short-term borrowing by the prior administration to get them through what they thought was a two-year problem. That's what we've done. We extended health care to tens of thousands of people who don't have health care in any other state. The legislature made that promise. The governor, my prior predecessor, made that promise. We had to find a way to pay for it. We're doing those things at the same time that we're making very valuable decisions about what services should be continued and what services should not be continued. That's a continuum. You're doing that on a constant basis, and you're creating efficiencies, as we just did in early childhood education, but as we've done across the board. There are many fewer state workers in the state of Connecticut today than there were. And you know, we're getting those kinds of efficiencies. So to say that, well, there's a target number out there that presents a gap, we're not going to have a gap. We're going to live within our means. We said we were going to do it. That's what we're doing. That's what we're going to do. And then, of course, we're also going to evaluate where the economy is as time goes forward so that we can make appropriate decisions about how much money we have to spend and, therefore, what our priorities are in spending it.
A last thing before we take our break. You just mentioned the word gap, so it made me think of gap accounting. Of course, one of the things that you ran on when you ran for governor was this idea of instituting generally accepted accounting principles, something that the state has not run in the past. It's been difficult to actually make this transition because it's very, very expensive to do. How are you planning to make this transition? Are you going to have to essentially borrow money to cover a transition to GAAP over time? I mean, how's this going to work? Because right now we don't have the money to make this transition.
Yeah, we are compliant with generally accepted accounting principles. So let's be very clear. However, in that compliance, we have about a $1.1 billion deficit that was never reported because they played games with the books. So we have been running with that on our, and basically that's always existed. I didn't create that. That's always existed. But when you grabbed revenue from different years and pulled it in, you hid that. So there is a proposal, and it's possible that to pay a portion of the gap, if I might, mm-hmm. the generally accepted accounting principle gap that was discovered once we converted to generally accepted accounting principles, there is a possibility that a portion of that would be borrowed at very low interest rates for that purpose, and basically locking us in to the recovery from what was done inappropriately for years and years.
And essentially setting up a fund that wouldn't be able to be touched that would just make this transition, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so is there any way that this money could be touched if, again, we hit a rainy day and, well, once again it's another bad year?
This is, first of all, it would be written into the bond, so that for that purpose. And I'm not the treasurer, so I'm going to defer.
Trust me, I'm not either.
I'm going to defer. Yeah. One of the problems that the gap, that is the money we don't have that we used to pretend we did, mm-hmm. Is that the amount of money we run on a month-to-month basis in the bank is that much shorter.
Yes.
So you will remember that folks were being very critical of my administration because we were running the books with very little money in the bank. That's a reality. We were, because of the gap. So we're trying to address that. And the technicalities and how all of that works, we'll get you somebody else to walk you through it.
Well, we'll take a break now. And we've got some people lined up who want to ask questions of the governor at 860-275-7266. We're getting lots of tweets and emails as well. We're also on CTN Live today. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, the last week of June is a big week for Supreme Court watchers. On the next edition of our news roundtable, The Wheelhouse will break down some decisions with our experts and hear reaction from you. We'll also check in on the special election in Massachusetts to fill John Kerry's Senate seat. You can join the conversation coming up on the next Where We Live. Today in the program, we're talking with Governor Dana Malloy. He's making his monthly visit to our program, taking some of your questions. So let's go to Paul in Plymouth. Hi there, Paul. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live with the governor.
All right, Governor, Your Excellence, this is Citizen Paul. As you're aware, there's been a lot of criticism of your lack of attention to making government more efficient. In other words, through the bidding process, through downsizing government, there's a lot of this criticism that's been coming from within government, within your own state agencies. You just wrapped up giving out a lot of money at the bonding session. Looking down the list there, it looked like a lot of economic development for private concerns.
Okay.
Could you hit on a couple of my concerns?
Paul, thank you. I'll let him hit on some of those concerns. By the way, I made an announcement earlier. I didn't know Your Excellence. This is nice. I can refer to you this way.
Citizen Malloy. Hey, listen, Paul. I've said it a couple of times while I've been on the station today. We are down over 1,000 people in state government, and yet you say we haven't made the government smaller. We have. It is substantially smaller today than the day I was sworn in. That's what we've done. And we've cut billions of dollars out of the budget. And we're projecting to save $26 billion in future expenses by the changes that we've made. And we're going to be fully funding our pension and other post-employment obligations, which we've never done before in the history of state government. So other governors got to spend the money that they weren't putting into the pensions, and I'm now taking care of that mess. So, Paul, I hear you. Rome wasn't built in a day, didn't decline in a day, didn't make its comeback in a day. And I got hired to try to straighten this thing out, and I'm doing the best I can, making it smaller while we're growing 36,000 private sector jobs in the state of Connecticut. All in all, not a bad 2.5 years worth of work. At the same time that we took the steps to reform public education in the state of Connecticut, a package that's been called the most comprehensive package in America, passed at any one time. At the same time that we took on the issue of gun safety in the state of Connecticut. You know, I'm moving as fast as I can, and I'm trying to get as many of these issues taken care of. But it doesn't happen overnight. Now, with respect to the bond agenda, you're absolutely right. We are making investments in Connecticut's future. We are working with companies that want to grow and stay and enlarge their footprint in the state of Connecticut. About 650 of those companies are small businesses. Before I became governor of the state of Connecticut, we had no small business function. We didn't interact with small businesses. We told them to take seminars. We told them to take courses at our colleges and universities, but we didn't make investments in them. We're making investments in them because in America, 60% of all job growth is in small businesses, and most job growth is combined in small businesses and in companies that are less than 5 years old. If we're not making those investments and helping those companies, particularly at a time that they can't access private capital, then we're going to lose out in the long run.
And Paul, thank you very much for your question. I have to ask you, Governor, about Keno. Keno is coming to Connecticut. How will the Keno contracts be awarded? Do we understand anything about how Keno is actually going to be implemented here in the state?
It's going to be implemented by it's implemented by the lottery system. And again, that was not my proposal. I didn't put that in the budget. That is a proposal. And when we say coming to Connecticut, it's in Massachusetts, it's in Rhode Island, and it's in New York. In fact, Keno is getting ubiquitous in the United States. It is in our state as opposed to other states. My presumption is that it would be run by the lottery as a lottery game.
Run by the lottery. So this is not going out to bid to some private companies.
No,
to run
I believe. Again, this is this is all in development because this got into the budget rather late in the budget document. In the formulation of the budget was not a proposal of mine. But as I understand the proposal, it would be a lottery game.
It did get in very late and without any sort of public comment. It seems. Does that sit well with you? The fact that now we're going to be changing law in a way that's going to bring some people would suggest a highly addictive gambling activity to the state without any sort of public comment period. This sounds as though something that maybe we should have some hearings on or something.
Can I just point one thing out about highly addictive activities? Our gaming revenue is down very substantially in Connecticut. That's the reality, and in fact, it's reflected in the budget. So in point of fact, there's less gambling going on in Connecticut today than there has been at any time.
People don't have as much money to give to the casinos.
And fewer people are coming to the state for that purpose because that competition has also become ubiquitous. In New York, in Massachusetts, in Rhode Island, New Hampshire is about to pass a law either this session or probably next session. Maine, that's a reality. Listen, I grew up in America where there was one place you could legally gamble. It was Las Vegas. In many ways, I think it was a better America. So don't Don't get me wrong.
No, I'm not
an advocate of gaming. On the other hand, I understand that we have a lottery system, and the legislature would like to tap into an additional revenue source that's not a tax-based revenue source. That's a decision they made.
But to many people, though, the tribal casinos, the genius of them was that there was not anything like that in the Northeast, and people came from states away to come there. And as you say, those revenues have shrunk as people have less substantially as people have less money. By instituting something that is in every state like Keno, you are essentially taking money from the people of Connecticut to help fund the general fund. I mean, some people look at it as a tax, an additional tax on people.
I suppose. I mean, you know, we tax cigarettes, we tax beer, we tax alcohol, we tax a lot of things and have the tradition of doing that. This is something that people do for personal enjoyment. They make a decision. I'm not aware of indicators that say that we have a larger gambling problem than other states within our borders by citizens within our borders. On the other hand, what I would say to you is we're putting in the same amount of money to fight gaming addictions as we were when there was a lot more money being invested in gaming in our state, or there's a lot more revenue. So this is something that we have to work on. I think if it's going to be done, it should be done within the lottery system, and it should be tightly controlled. And we'll see where we go with this. This was, you know, again, this was not my proposal.
Are you running for re-election in 2014?
You know, I've never hidden the fact that I like this job, that I think it's a longer-term commitment to actually turn the state around. I think that you know, I've managed for the long haul, and in the hopes that the short term will take care of itself, and we'll cross that other bridge that you just talked about when we get to it.
We understand that your former chief of staff, Roy Occhiogrosso, is actually forming a super PAC. So he's going to be raising money for political campaigns. Are you talking with him about this? I mean, how does that work?
I don't think you're right. So
he's not.
I don't think so.
Okay. In terms of how we raise money, are you going to be a publicly financed candidate if you run again in 2014?
Most likely I would. I support that system. You know, Citizens United was a terrible curse, in my opinion, on the United States, and has brought changes in the United States that could not have been anticipated taking place. The idea that foreign corporations can invest and spend money in helping to decide American elections, in my opinion, is scary. But having said that, I think we have a good system, and I think in many ways we've increased transparency in the legislation that the legislature adopted just recently. But if you're asking me whether I support the system, the answer is yes.
And a last thing, because we just have a minute or so left, the Quinnipiac poll came out this week. It seems to be signaling the start of this 2014 race. What do you make of the fact that you're trailing Tom Foley, who you beat in the last election by a few points in this race? I understand it's very early, but I need to ask you.
Well, you can ask me that. I mean, listen, the same poll had me at the same time behind my Democratic rival in a primary. It had me down by 22 points. I won that poll, which was the election in that case was in August. I won by 16 points. Early polls are actually, if you go a year before, that poll had me at 6 points in the electorate. So I just think that the polls will take care of themselves. But I do think it also reflects something else. And that is that I have not shied away from making tough decisions, whether it's on education reform, whether it's changing how we fund things in the state of Connecticut, whether it's restacking our relationship with my fellow state employees, whether it's investing in small startup firms, whether it's investing in the university system. I've made some really tough choices, and that ruffles some feathers. But I think people also understand that I'm doing the best I can to lead, and I think they appreciate leadership, and the rest of it will take care of itself. And I'm not going to change. I'm not going to manage for the short term. I'm going to manage for the long term in the hopes that the short term takes care of itself. But if it doesn't, I'll at least be able to look myself in the mirror when I shave every day.
Governor Daniel Malloy, thank you once again for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry we couldn't get to more phone calls. Some problems with our phone lines, but we'll have the governor back again next month as always. And we'll continue this conversation online at WNPR.org, keyword where. As a matter of fact, we've got a new Facebook page for Where We Live. You can like us there. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.
Thank you.